If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
Pixel Sift is proudly supported by the Murdoch University School of Arts. And if you're looking for a creative degree, maybe in games, maybe in journalism, maybe in film, or you want to mix and match between any of those fields, they might have what you're looking for. If you're keen to learn more, you can head to the Murdoch website. That's murdoch.edu.au/arts to find out what they've got on offer. So murdoch.edu.au/arts. Tell them that Pixel Sift sent you there. We're proud alumni of Murdoch University and really appreciate the support that Murdoch University School of Arts have given us over the years. Pixel Sift. Hello and welcome to 150 episodes of Pixel Sift. This is episode 150. It's a show dedicated to the people who work creatively in the games industry in Australia, in New Zealand, in Southeast Asia, and around the world. Now, it's a big milestone for us. We started this thing back in 2015. So over the 5 years we've been doing it, we've spoken to 185 games industry guests on this podcast. We've spoken to 116 people on the show floors of the 4 years of PAX Australia that we've been there and made countless friends along the way. So just to kick off, I thought it'd be really nice to say thank you to everyone in the games industry who shared their time with us and shared their stories of what it's like to actually make games over the last years. A lot of things have changed. A lot of things have stayed the same, but we really appreciate that you have shared your story with us over these 150 episodes. And I'd like to thank a big thank you to our current team. So that's James Morrison, Mitch Lowe, Scott Quigg, Adam Christou, Daniel Ang, Jason Head, Vivian Thumb, Sarah Ireland, Fiona Bartholomeus, and our past contributors, Nick Byrne, Brian Fairbanks, Vaughan Hunt, and Kyle Dublin, who've all helped us make this show. Now, my name is Gianni Di Giovanni. I'm the executive producer of Pixel Sift. And tonight, my guest and my friend and my co-host is Fiona Bartholomeus. Hello, Fiona.
Hello.
It's very exciting to be on episode 150, and we've got a great esteemed guest on the show. This milestone episode, it's Matt Ditton, who's the CEO of Mighty Games. And Matt, thank you so much for being a part of this episode.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me. This is it's an impressive milestone for you. Well done.
Thank you. It's really exciting, and we're really looking forward to hearing a bit about your creative journey over the years, where you've kind of been, where you've gone to, where you are now, and what it feels like to make games in 2020, which is very challenging.
Yeah, like Gianni said, so Shooty Skies and Mighty Games have been the pinnacle of Australian game industry for a very long time. So it's fitting that we have you on for our 150th episode. So we'll be chatting a bit about Shooty Skies Overdrive and how Mighty Games got their start.
All right, shall we get into it?
Australia's best video game podcast.
Subscribe to Pixel Sift on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever podcasts are found.
So our guest this evening is Matt Ditton, who's the CEO of Mighty Games, here to tell us all about their brand new game, Shooty Skies Overdrive. Now, people might know what Shooty Skies is. They may have, if they've picked up a phone in a long time, they would have definitely seen it pop up at some point. But Matt, can you tell us, what is Shooty Skies Overdrive? Give us a bit of a rundown of what it all is.
Well, okay, so we made the sequel to Shooty Skies, but we made it for the Oculus Quest. So it's a VR experience. It's available on the Quest and the Rift and soon to coming to Steam. And it is a bullet hell shooter in VR. And people have called it like manic Tai Chi, where you're basically stuck, you know, you're transported to the world of Shooty Skies in this like voxel, like 80s sort of like environment where the way we think about it is like the internet came alive and wants to kill you. And you have Shooty Cat and all of Shooty Cat's friends on your hand. And your goal is to keep Shooty Cat alive and take out all the enemies that want to shoot you. Yeah. It's fun.
So Shooty Skies, if people kind of haven't come across it, it's sort of an infinite scrolling shooter, similar to games that people might have played like 1942, the arcade era. Is that a fair sort of assessment?
Yeah,
of what it
totally.
Is?
Like I've always been a big shmup fan. Mm. And when we were sitting down originally and thinking about like, okay, what do we want to what's a good game to make back in, you know, 2015, when we were releasing Shooty, like one of the big things was that I was a big fan of shmups. And so it was like, can we make an endless shmup? Can you make a game that's like, you know, kind of procedural, kind of varied, like it's got a whole bunch of weird stuff in it. And then can you make it funny? Like that was always the big thing of like dumb jokes are a big thing at Mighty. Like, you can't go wrong with a pun. And so we wanted to make something that was like stupid and funny and then make it a bullet hell. So like take something that's generally a kind of like hardcore gamer kind of experience, but then try and make it for everybody, which is a great, you know, it was a good sort of design challenge.
It's interesting because I think about those arcade games when I used to play them, and a lot of the way that they sort of play out is that sort of push to get you to put another 25 cents in, another dollar or whatever. And a lot of the gameplay is sort of centered around that. And you're challenging yourself, but it's also design. How did you sort of think about that when you were bringing it over to a mobile platform and playing the game that way?
Oh, look, I think it's interesting the design differences between like the mobile version and the VR version, because like, when we did the original mobile version, it was free to play. It was like we wanted to build it for absolutely everybody. If you had a phone, you could play the game. And we didn't want the price point to be a barrier. So it was really about like, this thing is free and we want everybody to enjoy it. And, you know, so that actually works really well with this notion of like coin-op arcade kind of, you know, feed coins in to like, get to the next level kind of mechanic. Like they've got a lot of similarities, those sort of design choices. And so really it was about like these like fast burst bits of gameplay that were compelling but punishing, but you wanted to keep playing more. And then it would kind of like slow unlock stuff as you went. And then along the way, we just showed you a whole bunch of ads. So yeah, that was...
That's how you pay for it.
Yeah, it was the style at the time.
Yeah.
You know, people were really into ads. Yeah.
So what made you decide to bring Shooty Skies into a VR world? Because they're very different platforms to me, just having it on your phone and then having something that's very immersive.
Yeah, look, I have to, I really have to take my hat off to my friend Matt Hall, because I'd played VR stuff and I'd really liked it, but like he'd played VR stuff and he was like an original DK1, you know, backer. Like he's a true believer. And he'd always wanted to make a VR title. And I thought VR would be a kind of cool thing to do one day. But there was this, he turned up and gave me a go at the Oculus Quest. And because I'd used everything, I tried the Vive and I tried the lot of it, and I was like, oh yeah, this is actually all pretty cool. But then I basically tried the Quest, and at that point, because it's such a unique platform. You know, it doesn't have cables. It's you know, inside out tracking. You know, there's no base stations or whatever. You just like put it on and then you're there and you play it. Like it's the promise of what VR was always meant to deliver, right? So that kind of like that solved the hardware problem. And then we were thinking it'd be cool to make something. And then Matt was like, have you ever played Zortex? And so I went and played Zortex in the lab in this you know, it's a very old title. You know, it's hidden away in the Steam lab. And it's a very rudimentary, simple bullet hell. And he was like, you know, if you took Zortex, but then you made it shooty, that could work. I was like, it's not a stupid idea. Like, let's give that a try. And so, yeah, it was a gag. Like, fundamentally, we did it as a weird experiment where he called me up one day and he was like, try this out. What do you think of this and this? And it was like, might work. And so, yeah, it was one of those things where we originally set out to just see if it was a good idea. And then it just kept being a good idea for like 10 months. And then we released a game. Like that's pretty much how it went. We were like, this works. It looks really good. We took it to PAX last year and PAX Australia. And yeah, people liked it and played it and had a great time. And then we were like, all right, yeah, we just have to finish this thing. Let's do it. Let's make a great game. So, yeah, we just – it was one of those strange things where we're like, we never originally set out to think, yes, this is exactly how the sequel to Shooty Skies should be. But we just accidentally was like, actually, this is what the sequel to Shooty Skies should be. Like, you should go to 3D. It should be immersive. VR is great. Let's just double down and do it.
What did you keep between that experience and bring it to VR? Like, what is the quintessential Shooty Skies experience that needed to be brought into VR? And what did you have to jettison?
Well, I mean, there's a few things that were very particular. Like it's got a look. You know, Shooty Skies is this voxel kind of art, and you know the effects are very particular, and so we wanted to really maintain that aesthetic. Like that was an important thing, and so finding ways to double down on that was like super important. But then the other thing was very particular was that the wave design in the game was like oddly specific. So Shooty, the original Shooty, you know, it's a shmup, but it's a fairly unique shmup because it's actually it's actually random, and it's actually like this procedural random. And so that's a very strange thing in the history of shmups. They're usually like pretty, you know, they're like bullet hells are designed so that you kind of massage muscle memory to like understand how to get through the level.
Like memorizing the waves is what I used to remember to do.
That's exactly right. Yeah. That's exactly right. Whereas Shooty is about you memorize the enemy patterns that appear, and the enemy patterns will change. Like they'll change, the order will change, but their behavior is consistent. And so you kind of create this like, you know, it's far more about the dodging than it is about the shooting, really. And so that was the big thing. It's like, all right, well, when this gets into 3D and I can move up and down and backwards and forwards, how do we make sure that like it's really about the dodging? You know, that's the key. Like if you can just dodge long enough and you take your time, you can defeat anything. That was the most important kind of thing. And so there was this weird constant iteration that we had, which was about like, all right, are these bullets working? Does this wave work? If you put all these things together, does it feel right? Yeah, so the team did a massive amount of like iteration of like, does this feel good? Do we keep playing it? Does this work? It's like, oh, that sucks, you know. Oh, this works. So, yeah, that was really the kind of the big thing, was like this strange bit of like wave design that was just sort of really integral. So,
and
it's also the stuff that no one would really look at. Like everybody just goes, oh yeah, it's just about voxels. It's like, well, yeah, sure. But it's actually about this like feeling as you play it. So, yeah.
You've mentioned dodging a bit there. Is that meaning like dodging physically, you have to avoid everything?
Yeah, yeah. It's you know, it's like the secret of the game is like Shooty Cat is in your hand and you just have to keep Shooty Cat alive. So you just have to weave, you gotta do this like slow motion weave through all of these bullets that are kind of coming at you. And it's about like what's completely unique in VR, and the thing that makes VR like just perfect is sort of spatial awareness, like understanding depth and how far this thing is away from you and where this thing is over here. And so what's brilliant about that is for a bullet hell, it's perfection, because you just have this like this area in which you kind of do this bizarre dance of the character. And yeah, it was cool. It was great.
That's the Tai Chi element, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, because you want to create these moments of like frantic chaos, and then like, okay, yeah, I have total mastery of what's going on. So yeah, it was great.
But there is also a seated version, well, a seated gameplay version. What's the difference between standard and seated?
Well, it's really so the Oculus has this guardian, right? And so you can define the region of play where you want to like experience the game. And the Guardian is really about this like area around you that is like where your hands and your face is going to be. And so if you're seated, you've got this like 1 meter space, but then if you're in a room, you can make it the size of a warehouse. And so what we tried to do was sort of use the Guardian spacing to kind of influence like how much the enemies are going to start targeting towards you. So if you actually have a lot of space, actually moving becomes a large part of the game, where you start to duck and weave and like crouch down and move around. But you can do the whole thing seated, kind of like moving your hand and these like weird motions. So it was a very hard balance. Like, it was an oddly difficult problem. So, yeah.
One of the things about bullet hells, whenever I've played them, they get to a point with an intensity that is really, like, can be quite stressful unless you get into that nice little flow state. But as you're learning to play it, it can be tricky. And I imagine people learning a bullet hell in VR could be quite confronting. How did you sort of balance that out?
It really came down to pacing. Like, you know, I mean, I think the audience is out as to whether or not we've kind of nailed it. Like, people are happy and people like the game. It's reviewing well. But I think there was this case of, like, you know, you need to make something that when you die, it doesn't feel punishing. Like, it feels like, oh, yeah, okay, I understand why. I can solve that problem next time. So you want this like real satisfaction in the gameplay where if something goes wrong, you understand how to fix it next time so that you can get better. And if you can achieve that, then it's like, okay, now it's about like go easy on saturating the player with lots of difficulty, you know, like space that out. So it's like, you know, you really just want these moments of relaxation where you feel like a total master. And then you want the chaos to set in, so you have to kind of like, you know, frantically run around the room and avoid stuff. Yeah. Took a while.
I can imagine it, but obviously it was fun over that 10 months you sort of said that you were kind of working on it. When the original Shooty Skies came out, it kind of landed at a moment where mobile games were basically having this nice sort of real great moment, really, to be. And do you think that VR is at the same point now? Is that part of the reason why you made this sequel in VR? Has it reached that point for you?
Oh, look, I think the really interesting thing about VR is that, like, it's always been a really interesting platform, but as a platform, it had this limitation of technology. You know, there was a bar you had to hit, like. You needed like base stations and a giant graphics card, and you know you needed a high level of technical knowledge to kind of settle this stuff up. And that's a barrier for an audience to get over. But when the PlayStation VR came out, like that was a pretty impressive moment where it's like, yeah, you've got a PS4, so just plug this thing in. What do you know? You've got a VR headset, and it's like all of a sudden, people are able to play this and understand what it is, and you're like, oh, it's just widening out that market. And then when Oculus brings out the Quest, it's like this thing standalone. Everything is, it's got a high quality bar. It's really well curated. The hardware is really great. Things have to be made for this piece of hardware. And you've got this like, well, that's a console. Like that's a platform. Like I know how to build something for a console. And that's like this first step towards like a future of VR consoles that are really like, yep, I can make something. I can put it on this console. I know that people will experience it and have a great time. So it's actually like a really great like beginning point for VR in my mind.
Like I've always like a thought standard like set of hardware or something like that. Is that kind of what you mean? Rather than say, you know, if you're building for the Rift or you're building for, you know, the original Oculus, you kind of had to rely on a variety of different hardware setups at home.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so you kind of run this problem then where like, you really, because people are on desktops and they've got fantastic graphics cards, you really just want to push it because you just want to give everybody everything. But then you hit the problem where it's like not everybody has everything. So, you know, your shaders go through the roof, your textures go through the roof, your load times get really high. And then people have to just tweak a million settings to like feel like they don't have the best version of the game. And that's always a bit disappointing. Whereas when you have a console, it's like, yeah, I just play a console and I get the version of the game, which to a certain extent I think was one of the great things about, you know, mobile sort of like 5 or 6 years ago when particularly in Australia, we had all these studios that were dealing with consoles and they were sort of like understanding these like, we build it for this platform and this is what we do. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, the platform is a phone. Ah, right. Okay, so I just have to make it to work on this phone. And with those constraints, you end up having like this like explosion of Australian talent of people that can make really great stuff that's like really compelling and interesting. And yeah, maybe, I hope, VR is doing the same kind of thing now. So, yeah.
So with Shooty Skies Overdrive being quite successful, are there any plans for turning any of the other app games you've worked on into VR?
Piffle VR?
We've joked about it a few times, but it's just a lot of cats getting thrown at blocks. So, which is well in our wheelhouse. Like we're a fan of cat-based humor.
It sounds goofy. It sounds like it would be good.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, you know, it ticks a few boxes.
Yeah.
But I think to make something really good, you have to somehow find that great hook, that good little piece of interaction that like is really super satisfying. So yeah, like the Tai Chi bullet hell dancing is like a great VR hook. Like it's like, yeah, you can't have this experience on anything else because it makes sense here. So if I can figure out the Piffle VR hook, yeah, totally. We'll bring that across. So, yeah.
Can you tell me a little bit about, I guess, Mighty Games? Does it feel like it's in a position now where you can have this sort of experimental sort of release? Because VR is still an emerging technology. I think a lot of people would sort of agree with that. But you're now at a place where you are able to make a game like Shooty Skies Overdrive?
Oh, look, it's not simple. And it's... you know, the kind of truth of Australian independent game development is really a kind of, you know, it's this story of like scrounging and figuring things out and being very scrappy with the way that you work. So like, you know, Mighty is actually a very complicated company in that it makes games and it actually does this like build and test software as a service for different companies. And then it also does, you know, serious games kind of contracting. So it's really got this like, you know, three different arms and each one kind of feeds into the other. So we're not, you know, even though it looks like yeah, totally. We just made this Shooty Skies game and everything's great. It's like, well, actually, to make that Shooty Skies game, we had to do all this other stuff. And then, you know, Film Victoria helped us out. And then Matt Hall as ClickTok kind of helped us out. And so there's this kind of like juggling of like, you know, keeping plates in the air to like kind of find a way to make all this stuff. But I think that reality is pretty common for a lot of Australian developers. You know, you're kind of like, you run up against this barrier of, you know, you don't have infinite money and infinite contacts. So you really have to find a way to like, you know, express what you want to do and like find a great hook in what it is so that it communicates the goal of like, yeah, we've made this game. We think it's really great. Let us on the platform. Awesome. You know, those kind of conversations and figuring out how to make those kind of games is kind of a, you always get nervous when you're trying to make it all work. So there's not this magic moment where it's like, I get to sit back and just smoke a cigar and go, today we're going to build something for a fantasy.
Make me a VR game. Uh-huh. Make me a PlayStation 5 game. So does it still feels like a hustle then to you? Does it feel like you're still sort of juggling a lot of stuff, even though you've had a number of really quite successful releases?
Oh, look, I've always thought that games are a hustle. Like there's no, it's a really interesting business. Like I find it really, really fun and I find it very interesting, but at the same time, like I've always viewed it as, you know, it's a business and there's 13 people at Mighty and everybody's got a wage and I got to find a way to pay everybody. And you want to make sure that everybody's got everything they need. And, you know, that paycheck's got to be there every week. So there's a definite kind of, as much as everything is fun and we try to make something that's great, you got to run it seriously. So, yeah, it's a hustle, but I wouldn't change it. Like, it's a good hustle. Like, you know, yeah.
Now let's go back a little bit to the beginning for you, Matt. When did you first get the games industry?
Well, my first job in games was in January of 2000. I interviewed as an artist at Chrome Studios, and John Passfield and Steve Stamatiadis interviewed me with Rob Walsh. And they needed someone to make background assets for Championship Surfer. And I think I got the job because I was very cheap. And I think that like maybe I was funny. And I distinctly remember John and Steve from when I was in high school. And I remember them from the comic store, which was Comics Etc. back in Brisbane, the best comic store. So I remember them coming to the comic store and I was a kid and I was like, oh, yeah, those guys made Halloween Harry. I pirated that game. And so I remember telling them that joke, like, yeah, I pirated your game. Not in any way understanding that, like, yeah, I stole money from you. Sorry about that. But somehow that enamored them to me and they gave me the job. But I don't think that was actually a special thing because back in 2000, no one wanted to work in games. It was just like there was nothing around. There were no schools. There was no university degrees. It was just like a bunch of scrappy morons who decided, we're really into figuring out how to make PlayStation 1 titles or things for the Dreamcast. So I got my first run there. I stayed there for 5 years. I was making background characters for Championship Surfer. I did all the rubber duckies in the arcade mode, which was great. And then I worked on Tiger the Tasmanian Tiger, version 1, 2, and 3. I was the background artist, and then I was like a lead artist on that for all the way through. And I distinctly remember I actually came up with the idea of the boomerangs. That is
a pretty integral part.
That's right. That's right. I was, and that again is like pure luck of me being in the room when the conversation happens of like, yeah, we need this character and it needs like a, up close attack and then a ranged attack. And I'm like, oh yeah, just throw a boomerang. It's like done. And you know, so, and then in 2005, like I went and moved to, Pandemic and started right at the very tail end of Destroy All Humans, and then I was doing the tech art for Destroy All Humans 2. So yeah, and that's when I met like Morgan and Dan and Sean from Defiant, and got to know like a bunch of other people around, you know, Brisbane scene. And yeah, I was there all the way through till we kind of like shut the doors in the GFC in 2009.
Because it was a real moment, really, because Australia had quite a lot going on. We had a, were really competitive. We had a number of studios all around the place. But then the GFC came through and a lot of people were then kind of, I guess, scattered to the wind and have kind of done. What did that feel like at that moment? You know, you'd worked your way up. You'd put, sort of been in the industry for a while and then all of a sudden it's gone. Your job's gone.
Look, it was pretty devastating situation. I mean, the thing that, you know, the alien idea now is that at the time Brisbane had like four or five sort of major studios with hundreds of people sort of working in them, and at its peak, like Pandemic had like 185 people across two teams. And you know, Chrome was the biggest company in Australia, like in the games industry. It grew to about 400 people across. It had a Brisbane, Melbourne, and Adelaide office. Like it was insane. And then on top of that, they were actually like outsourcing a ton of stuff to various studios all over the country. So it was like, you know, everyone had so much work on that there was just this like huge problem of like, how do we just, oh my God, how do we just get all this work done? So it was a completely different world. And then in the space of like, you know, you kind of watch this slow motion train wreck happen for 12 months. And the whole country just kind of fell apart. And it was tragic. Like it was just a horrible situation. And, you know, a lot of people picked up and they moved, and, you know, multinationals were surprisingly good that way, and that if you worked for them in one place, you could kind of interview and go work somewhere else. So there's a lot of Australians that are overseas now that have been there for, you know, 10 years since the GFC, and they're like, you know, integral parts in major companies. You know, like Rob Davis is a great example. Like Rob Davis did all this work on the latest God of War, and he's an amazing guy, but I remember him at Chrome as this like, you know, shit kicking level designer. And then he went to Pandemic and was a shit kicking level designer there. And then, you know, that all falls apart. And then Rob goes off to Santa Monica and, you know, grows into this amazing kind of, you know, AAA game developer. And that's actually the story of a huge amount of Australian talent. It's like Australians are very good. Like we're very smart and we're very talented. And it turns out that we have these skills that work around the world. So
was that a temptation to pack up and head overseas?
Yes and no. Like, you know, I grew up in Brisbane and I was so incredibly lucky that the Brisbane industry kind of grew up at the time when I was, you know, looking for my first big job in the industry, and then it kind of grew as I grew. And so I was incredibly privileged to get that opportunity. But I didn't necessarily want to kind of, you know, I didn't necessarily feel that my adventure in Australia had ended. It was kind of like, okay, well, this is a different kind of scenario. Like maybe there's a different way to make games. Like maybe I can still do all the stuff that I really love, but I can still do it here. And then, it was like, it was a it was a very interesting time because it was this, you know, mobile had just started, like the iPhone had just turned up, and that felt amazingly revolutionary. And that felt like, you know, maybe you could just make something and put it on this phone, and then maybe you could just make money. And Fruit Ninja happened, and, you know, I can remember Halfbrick when they were outsourcing to Chrome. Like Chrome was outsourcing to Halfbrick. And I remember Chenille and Dan before they did Fruit Ninja. And then all of a sudden they did Fruit Ninja, and now Halfbrick is the guys that did Fruit Ninja. And it's like, wait a minute, you can still make games in Australia. Like that's how you do it. So that was kind of the crux of it. You know, the GFC happens, and in my mind, I'm like, I could go and work for somebody else, but maybe I could find a way to work for myself and figure that out. So, yeah.
So, Matt, how did you make the jump from art to then being a CEO and a producer?
Well, I've been very lucky in that no one's told me that I shouldn't do those things. So, yeah, it's been a really, like, my career is very, very strange. Like I'm trained as a classical photographer. Like I got a photography degree before I started in the games industry. And but then I was really into computers, and I was really into 3D modeling. And then during my time in pandemic, I became very interested in data and like the data behind 3D modeling, and then the optimizations of the way things worked. And then I became very interested in coding. So I sort of taught myself how to program, and I did all these freelance jobs, programming for advertising agencies and all this kind of stuff. And then I kind of decided I could just do this. And so I just moved to Melbourne and started a company. And I wasn't dumb enough to think I couldn't do it, really. That's the truth.
Foolhardy bravado. Yeah. You just kind of pushed on, hey?
Yeah. I mean, thinking about it, I probably shouldn't have, but it's worked out. So, you know, I think it's been fine.
The moment you're kind of finding yourself in, like, right now, is you're actually back in Brisbane. You're working remotely, as a lot of people have been working. What does it feel like to have to move your whole studio into an online platform and ship a game to a bunch of people around the world, as everyone is trying to juggling bits of hardware and internet connections?
Yeah.
And how did that feel?
Yeah. As everyone says, 2020 is an experience, and we're all moving through it. It's been pretty weird, I'll be perfectly honest with you. Like, we're based in Melbourne, we have an office in Fitzroy, and we're just as hipster as it comes. Like, you know, we have our own coffee machine, and we're very snobby about it. You know, we're sitting on this gigabit fiber connection that I spend a fortune to maintain. And then all of a sudden in March, Melbourne's shutting down, lockdown time, everybody go home, you know, COVID's everywhere. And so, yeah, we just instantly transitioned to figuring out how to be a remote working studio. And it's a shock. Like, it's hard. It's very hard. And I would not recommend that everyone's first remote work game is a VR game. We had this huge problem of hardware, because we're a Mac store. Like, fundamentally, everyone has a Mac. And then we've got to make a Quest game, but then it's got to run on the Rift, and it's got to run on the Vive, and it's got to run all these things. And so we had limited PCs. So it's like, we had all these weird problems of like scarcity of hardware. In a perfect world, everyone would have all their own stuff and it'd be fine. But in a COVID world, there's just, you know, everything isn't quite where you want it to be, and not everyone has exactly what they need. So we had all these weird problems. Like, the classic one was, to make the trailer, we needed to get Live working, which is a plugin for mixed reality. And that only works on Steam. And so there's only one guy in the team that had a Vive, who also had a webcam, because not everybody had a webcam on a PC. So we couldn't actually, like, we needed a webcam to test it. So it turns out Matt DeLine happened to have all these things, but Matt DeLine wasn't working on Shooty. Gerard was working on Shooty. So Gerard had to call up Matt and basically, like, over the phone, explain to him how to set up this live studio to then, like, get screenshots so that we knew if it worked. And yeah, it sucks. Like, it's really hard. it's just really difficult. I will say that automation helps. The more you can automate stuff, the easier your life is. And that's really been just this a godsend for us. Like, Ben Britton, my, you know, co-founder of Mighty, he has this opinion that if you have to do something twice, you should just automate it. And so yeah, we ended up, we, you know, half the company runs automatically. So we just have this incredible, we ended up having to build this incredible toolkit so that you can check something in and then builds appear on everyone's devices and you can sort of test stuff. But yeah, it's really hard. It's like, yeah, running a team remotely, it's a pain, as you'd know. Mm. Like, maybe you don't. You're all in Perth. So,
well, some of us are in Perth, some of us remote. Yeah. We were locked down at one point as well, and it is a challenge. And then everyone else also has everything else going on in their life at the same time, which is a challenge as well. So I think being able to make anything this year, I think everyone deserves a round of applause pretty much. It's been a tricky year, but I reckon the art that's going to come out of 2020 is going to be phenomenal down the track. As people kind of get the, you know, as people get the opportunity to share it.
But yeah,
Matt, I mean, I think,
Oh no, please continue.
Oh, I was actually just thinking that, like, 2020 is going to be a very interesting year to look back on, because, like, I actually think that the best stuff to come out of 2020 will be, like, hopeful, interesting things that are, like, quirky and made everybody laugh. Because you know, the truth of the world is just so depressing that you just need these hopeful, fun things. Whereas, like, you know, you look at 2019 and, like, you know, Chernobyl, like the HBO show, is probably the best thing they did, or Watchmen, and it's just these are prescient, amazing things that are, like, infinitely depressing. And you know, you get to 2020 and it's like, I'd really just like to rewatch Gilmore Girls for a while, because that's quite nice. It's just people being nice to each other. Let's watch that for a while. Yeah.
So what sort of advice would you give, Matt, to an aspiring game developer in 2020?
Look, it would actually be the exact same advice that I'd always give a game developer, in that you just need to ship stuff, because the game that you ship will be the worst game that you make. So you need to ship it out so you can make the next one. And you just need to keep making things, because eventually you'll make something good. And that's really how I've lived my entire life. It's like, the goal is to try to make something good. And you ship something and all you see is all the stuff that wasn't there. Like, you kind of see that all the pieces that you missed and the decisions that weren't, that didn't take you down those paths. And so you kind of look at it and you think, look, it's good, but could have been amazing. And even if people love it, you can't view it with the same eyes. So game development's a difficult business, but if you view it as a business, and it's a business in the creative arts, like, it's a very powerful, fun, fascinating life. You know, it's a great life to live, making games. But the trick there is, like, make stuff and ship it and get it out into the world and move on and just keep making and keep doing things. That would be my advice.
Oh, well, that's absolutely something I think that we would agree with here, and I'm sure a lot of other people would probably take a bit of solace in that as they're chipping away at their projects and getting to that point. Now, that's pretty much all we've got time for, so if you're listening to this and you want to find out a bit more about Shooty Skies Overdrive, you can go to shootyskiesoverdrive.com. It's at Shooty Skies on Twitter. It's out right now on the Oculus Store and coming to Steam very soon on the 8th of August. Matt, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you and to learn a little bit about your story and the story of Mighty Games and how you kind of got to this point where you are right now.
Oh, look, it's My pleasure. It's really nice to talk to you guys. It's been great. I feel very privileged to be here on the 150th episode. Like, that's a huge achievement. You should be really proud of that.
Oh,
that's
thank awesome. You. It's one we're going to remember for a long time and one we'll hold up in esteem. Now, the team, and like anything with creative, it's all about the team, and Pixel Sift is produced by Scott Quigg, Sarah Ireland, Fiona Bartholomaeus, Mitch Lowe, Daniel Ang, Adam Christou, and my name is Gianni DiGiovanni. I'm the executive producer, and we wouldn't have been able to make 150 episodes if, one, people didn't listen to what we made and enjoyed it, and we didn't have the support of Murdoch University as well. So go check them out. Tell them that we sent you. If you're keen to learn more about a great creative degree, head to murdoch.edu.au/arts.
And you can also come join us on Discord if you want. We'd love to have you there. You can join us on pixelsift.com.au/discord, and you can share your creative work, what you've been watching, what you've been doing, talk about different topics, games, and everything else. That again was pixelsift.com.au/discord. And if you like what we do, can we ask you a favour? We need your help to share the show, so tell a friend, subscribe your brothers and sisters, start someone's journey into podcasts, because we know it's hard, a bit tricky trying to get in there, but once you're in there, you won't want to leave. You'll love it too much.
That's all we have time for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Matt, for being a part of this. Thank you, Fiona. Thank you, everyone, for 150 episodes of Pixel Sift. We will catch you all next time.
See ya.
See ya.
Did you know that the original Final Fantasy creator, Hironobu Sakaguchi, made a spiritual successor to that legendary series called Fantasian for Apple Arcade, and every level in the game is a handmade, physical miniature model? Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a 1 month free trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. This offer is for new subscribers only. $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.